Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Friday. It's August the 26th. A rare, but, well, not unheard of, live Friday Issues Etc. We just spent some time talking with Daniel Conrad. He had spent some time in the mission field. One of the first things he worried about as a missionary when it came to the misuse of the mission was what he found down there in Venezuela. People confusing basically helping social care, relief efforts with the preaching of the gospel. Well, the two, one does not have to be substituted for the other. The two go hand in hand. LCMS World Relief is showing that it can be done. Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts and connected to the message of the cross in a local congregation. That's what LCMS World Relief is all about. To find out more about them, you go to our website, issuesetc.org, or you can call them here in St. Louis, area code 314-996-1683, 314-996-1683. Our website address, again, is issuesetc.org. It's a relief agency that that really does care about both body and soul. LCMS World Relief. Well, Wednesday on Bill O'Reilly, there was a very interesting interview. Of course, intelligent design is all in the news. In Saturday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the religion section, there's the headline, "Debate Continues Over Teaching Alternatives to Evolution." And when we hear that term, alternatives to evolution, nowadays they're talking about intelligent design. We've talked a lot about it here on Issues Etc. O'Reilly was discussing it with Dr. Richard Sternberg, who's editor of a scientific journal called Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington. Why was he on O'Reilly? Well, this journal had published an article on intelligent design, and Dr. Richard Sternberg had received quite a bit of flap for doing just that. Now, this was the O'Reilly Factor television program on Fox News Wednesday. We'll pick up with O'Reilly and his interview with Dr. Richard Sternberg. Afterwards, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Menton of Washington University here in St. Louis about intelligent design.
1 year ago, the editor of a scientific journal called Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington ran an article by Dr. Stephen Meyer of Cambridge University in England that stated intelligent design should be taken seriously as a theory. Well, since that time, Dr. Richard Sternberg's life has been hell. He joins us now from Washington. Well, I just want to tell everybody that, you know, the federal government investigated your situation and found that you had been harassed because you allowed this article to be printed. I want to know what happened to you. What form did the harassment take?
Well, it took a number of forms, Bill. First of all, immediately after the article was published, there was a very tepid reaction within the museum. However, a number of outside groups and individuals began writing emails, letters of protest, phoning the museum, phoning my employer, demanding my ouster for this. Apparently there's an unstated rule that you do not accept a manuscript for peer review that counters Darwinism, or seriously counters Darwinism. And furthermore, I was a gatekeeper. I allowed the paper to be peer-reviewed, and furthermore, I committed the terrible sin of allowing it to be published. And so the retaliation that followed took the form of the spreading of misinformation, such that, you know, my degrees were in religion and philosophy, not in science, that there was actually no peer review. I had accepted money under the table.
All right, so they came after you viciously, and I know how that is. They do that to me every day. But who was behind this?
The retaliation occurred in concert. It was between the officials of the Smithsonian Institution, curators, various administrators, and the National Center for Science Education, based in Oakland, California. They orchestrated, for example, LISI, the National Center for Science Education, orchestrated a repudiation of the article, actually helped the repudiation to be drafted, that is a statement of retraction, and then turned around and cited it on their website as evidence, not so much evidence, but allowed them to strongly insinuate editorial malfeasance on my part. They aided in drafting, for example, a statement by the council that oversees publication of the journal, to suggest that somehow I had broken
but
rules.
The bottom line is that they wanted to ruin you for simply running an article by a scholar. I mean, in Cambridge University is one of the most prestigious universities in the world.
Yes,
that said,
right.
Look, you ought to take a look at this intelligent design and not just throw it out in the garbage.
Right.
So they tried to ruin you for doing that. And I'm not quite understanding. Is this an anti-religion movement? I mean, what are they afraid of here? What's the bottom line on it?
It's an attempt, I think, to suppress scientific dissent.
Why? What is it in it for these people to be so brutal toward anyone who might want to just take a look at intelligent design?
I think it's religiously and politically motivated. It's a form of projection. You have groups like the NCSE and others who argue that the intelligent design advocates, the creationists, et cetera, are trying to suppress information, trying to hinder science. And ironically, quite the opposite appears to have occurred in this situation. They felt that, you know, if, for example, the pros and the cons of the issue are placed on the scientific table, then essentially the whole edifice is going to unravel, and that simply cannot be allowed.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think this is a concerted effort in a fascist way to punish anyone who might want to inject the higher power into any scientific discussion. I mean, this is a real, let's get religion out of it completely and never deal with that aspect of it again. Doctor, thanks very much. We're sorry you had to go through what you went through.
All right, that's the audio from Bill O'Reilly's O'Reilly Factor on television Wednesday in his interview with Dr. Sternberg and what he went through. Joining us now in just a moment is Dr. David Menton. You might have seen the headline in Saturday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the religion section. Intelligent design should join evolution in the classroom, says Frist. That is the sidebar for a bigger story. Debate continues over teaching alternatives to evolution. As more choices weigh in, the argument over intelligent design may eventually wind up in the Supreme Court. I have no doubt about it. Sooner or later, the Supreme Court will be considering the issue of intelligent design in the classroom. Intelligent design, some have said, is the first scientific theory to really challenge in a serious way the presuppositions and the assertions of evolution and of Darwinism. Now, our guest here in just a few moments, Dr. David Menton, would say, no, not the first. Serious six-day creationism has also mounted a very serious scientific, rational argument against Darwinism. But intelligent design is the one that's making all the press nowadays. This idea that there is a designer behind the universe we see. Now, note a few things here. Intelligent design is not six-day creationism. Intelligent design doesn't even claim to say who the designer is, but it does assert, on the basis of what we see and can observe, that there must be a designer. Dr. David Menton is a regular guest on the program. He's Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University here in St. Louis, and he is a speaker for Answers in Genesis. Dr. Menton, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, we heard this interview from the O'Reilly Factor, and this editor of a scientific journal really catching some heat for publishing an article on intelligent design. Have you ever been looked down upon by your colleagues at Washington University for your position on the origins of life?
Well, you know, one doesn't know what goes on behind one's back, but one-on-one, you know, face-to-face, I really didn't have very many colleagues who wanted to discuss the issue. Maybe one that I can think of who was sufficiently upset and bold enough to talk. The rest, if they had reservations about my views, they didn't share them with me.
Is it safe to say that holding to the biblical picture, the six-day picture of creation, or holding to creation of any stripe, makes one in academia something of a rarity?
Well, certainly on a relative scale, there are many more people in academia who take a very secular view of the world. In fact, I guess there are surveys that have been done, but if you look at people who are, you know, major league scientists, the number of people who are biblical Christians among them are certainly very few. the number of people who are atheists or agnostics among, you know, the scientific community is relatively high compared to the rest of society, so you have a larger percentage. But just this weekend, and I guess I'll leave him unnamed in view of the hostility that's out there today, but I went to dinner a few days ago with a gentleman who has been several times nominated for the Nobel Prize. And he's a Christian, and I wouldn't agree with him on every point or detail, but he does believe there is, of course, a creator. So there are many distinguished scientists, and if we look historically, I would say those scientists who are the greatest movers and shakers in all of scientific history, people like Newton and Pascal, and you could go down the line. I mean, the biggest names in the history of science were also Christians, for the most part, and believed in a creator. So it hardly prevents one from doing science, no matter what you hear these days.
What is the theory of intelligent design in a nutshell?
Well, you know, intelligent design, I think, is what the average person on the street probably appreciates almost intuitively, and that is that when we look at nature, say biological systems, and the same thing could be said about the cosmos and astronomy and what have you, but let's stick to biology, that's my area. If you look at a human eye, just to pick one example, you have what is, for all practical purposes, a very, very sophisticated camera. It has automatic focus, very, very fast automatic focus. Instead of moving the lens, it actually changes the refraction of the lens. I don't think anyone's quite built a camera that way thus far. It has automatic exposure. The iris diaphragm opens and closes automatically with the light, a feature we see in automatic cameras. It has a dark interior so that light doesn't flash around and glance off things and ruin the image. It has a highly sensitive film, or in the case of the human eye, we call it a retina. This retina is sensitive to a single photon of light, which is the smallest unit of light that we know of, and yet is able to perceive light over a range of approximately 100 billion to 1. In other words, from a single photon to the brightest sun-drenched snowscape. It has autofocus that changes focus automatically wherever you look. Cameras only in recent years have come up with the ability to change focus where you're looking. I think Canon has a camera like that. Now, all of these features, were we to see them in a camera, we would attribute to an intelligent designer. I mean, that goes without question. A person would be simply mentally compromised who didn't see that a camera had an intelligent designer. But when we look at living systems, then people seem to think it's okay to think that nothing shows evidence of design, that everything could have occurred by chance. And the intelligent design movement says no. We have extraordinary complexity here, and there is no known way by which complex systems, highly integrated complex systems, can occur by random chance. I mean, it simply has not been demonstrated to occur. So intelligent design merely argues that in this day and age of informatics, when we can even quantify information in bits of information, we can show that biological systems show this information, and this information could not have occurred by random change in natural selection. And they do not argue necessarily who this designer is. They feel that we can scientifically deal with the issue that there is design without addressing the designer.
So intelligent design proposes a modest, but at the same time, earth-shaking proposition that what we can observe by way of order and apparent design is in fact ordered and designed.
That's right. You know, and if you look up the definition for design in a dictionary, it doesn't mean just simply order. I mean, you know, we could perhaps see something that would be perceived as order that could occur, you know, by chance, but The definition of design, if one looks at a dictionary and you see there are typically many different definitions for it or examples of it, but virtually all of the examples and definitions of design that appear in the dictionary imply forethought. So this is the key. You design something when you know what it is you wish to do before you do it, and then you set about to do it.
Isn't that the whole point of the eye illustration there, that such a thing can rationally only exist, the human eye, if someone says at the outset, I know what I want this to do, and I design it in such a way so that it will achieve those goals that I have for it?
You know, it's difficult to even talk about the human body without just assuming design. I spent 34 years in the faculty of Washington University School of Medicine, and during that time I not only gave many lectures to our fine medical students there, but I heard lectures given by other people, probably most of whom did not believe in a creator and did not believe in a designer. And yet, hearing their lectures, never mind mine, listening to their lectures, I would hear the word design pop up all the time. It's very difficult to talk about any organ in the body without talking about it as though it had a purpose. I mean, you ask somebody who's knowledgeable about the spleen what the spleen does, and they'll say, well, the spleen is designed to remove defective red blood cells and blood-borne materials from the bloodstream. It does for blood basically what a lymph node does for lymph. And when you look at the mechanism by which it does it, I mean, it's pretty incredible. It takes everything, runs it through like a little clothes wringer, kind of squeezes it down to see how flexible the cells are. And any cell not passing the test, there's a whole group of specialized cells waiting to sort of eat those cells up and get them out of circulation. You know, design is so obvious. We've reached a really incredible point. I really couldn't have believed 20 years ago we'd get to this point. But we've reached a point today where in the classroom it has essentially become illegal to even mention the possibility that the eye might show some trace of purpose or design. To me, this is so ludicrous, so patently outrageous, that I just think the students themselves ought to see through this. I mean, maybe the teachers don't, but the students will. And I think it's so outrageous, I just say, go for it. Go into the classroom and tell a student, we can't even consider the possibility of design. And see how ludicrous the students think their teachers and their textbooks are.
But isn't that precisely what many are arguing for when they talk about introducing, quote-unquote, alternatives to evolution in the classroom? And that is, if they are against introducing alternatives to evolution in the classroom, they are really talking about teachers and students, either in their teaching or in what they learn, denying what is intuitive when we observe in detail what the human body or other life is really doing.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, the evolutionists right now have put themselves in a position where they are just so adamant about the whole issue. I mean, they can't even tolerate the slightest criticism of their views. You know, there's two ways you could handle this in the classroom. One is to not present any other alternative. In other words, forget about intelligent design and forget about creation, forget about all these things. Just go into the classroom and say, well, what are we teaching? Well, what we are teaching is evolution. Well, fine. Let's then critically evaluate the evidence for evolution. If we can't present any alternative, okay, leave it out. But then why not critically evaluate the evidence for evolution? This wouldn't even involve intelligent design. You'd simply look at evolution and you'd say, well, what is the evidence that the variations that we see among the individuals of a species, for example, among dogs, we have almost 200 variety of dogs recognized by the American Kennel Club. They're all the same species, Canis familiaris. We have other animals that can interbreed with dogs, like wolves and coyotes and dingoes and jackals. These are all, well, not the dingo, but all of the others, the wolf, the coyote, the jackal, are all different species from dogs, and yet they interbreed, so I would consider them the same kind. You know, is this kind of variability that we see among the dogs, is it related to evolution? And evolutionists themselves, meeting some years ago at the University of Chicago, came to the conclusion that the variations that we see among the individuals of a species have nothing to do with macroevolution. Macroevolution being how we come to have, you know, lions and giraffes and wombats. Microevolution, which really isn't evolution at all, is how we come to have Chihuahuas and Great Danes. This kind of variability occurs within the species, Canis familiaris, but evolution has to go outside the species level and produce fundamentally new organisms that have never existed before, that breed true to form and are basically different. And we don't see that kind of thing. We see variation within kind all the time. You see it in plants, you see it in animals. We have the famous example of Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands. Peter and Rosemary Grant have studied these finches for the last 20, 25 years. And during this time, they've noticed that when the weather changes, the birds change a little bit. And they change from year to year and even month to month. If you study it statistically in a computer, you can show the beaks get a little longer one year and a little shorter the next year, a little broader, a little narrower. But they keep hovering about a mean, and over the long haul, they simply don't change.
So in other words, there is a spectrum of variation within those finches, but they stay within that spectrum, and they don't suddenly start waddling around like ducks or take to the water or do anything else like that if the environment would normally say that they should.
Absolutely. There was a major drought in the Galapagos here some years ago, and the Grant studied that and their colleagues, and they noticed that following the drought, the seeds that these birds eat developed a harder shell. They were more difficult to crack open, and that the beaks of the birds, those who survived, changed in the direction of a more robust beak, a little broader, a little deeper, a little stronger. But then when the rains returned and the plants started producing seeds that were more of the normal type, then that particular element of the population that had the more robust beak then became more like normal again, with the normal-sized beaks. And so they were seeing from year to year and even month to month small changes that varied about a mean, but you never went on to produce anything fundamentally new. Not only that, but in the Galapagos, there's about 13 species of these finches that are collectively known as Darwin's finches.
I want to take a break here, and when we come back, I want to finish that thought with Dr. Menton on those finches there in the Galapagos, and then we'll talk a bit about this concept of irreducible complexity and what role it plays in those who are saying, look, evolution isn't the only answer to where it all came from. Dr. David Menton is our guest. You're listening to Issues Etc. this Friday, August 26th.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you noticed how Sunday morning church has become more like the Oprah Winfrey Show? Pews filled with mostly women, music focused on subjective feelings rather than objective truths, preaching that sounds more like therapy than theology, and pastors who are afraid to take a stand. Is there still a place for real men in the church? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to visit Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, check out their website, www.ctsfw.edu, or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Real men attend Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, www.ctsfw.edu, or 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Organizations from the right and left are bombarding the news media with their opinions about Supreme Court nominee John Roberts. Perhaps unique among them is a group of women with extraordinary clout in the nation's capital. Bill Wilson has the story.
It looked like a who's who among powerful women in Washington. Their positions on the political spectrum varied, but not their support for Roberts, author, lecturer, and wife of Judge Robert Bork, Mary Ellen Bork.
I think he has the quality that counts most for a position on the Supreme Court, and that is that he will interpret the law and not create it. So we can feel that the Constitution is safe in his hands.
Karen Kerrigan of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council says justices such as Roberts are needed for fiscal sanity.
Judicial activism, legislating from the bench, clearly has led to legal uncertainty, which has contributed to the explosive costs in our legal system, topping more than $246 billion annually, which obviously puts all U.S. firms and our country at a competitive disadvantage in the global marketplace.
Attorney Brigida Benitez, who represents clients before the Supreme Court, concurs. America needs a Justice Roberts.
We need the talents of Judge Roberts to help resolve the critical cases in our society according to the Constitution and not according to the agendas of private interest groups.
They urged all American women to contact their senators in support of the nominee. For Family News and Focus, I'm Bill Wilson in Washington.
The Women for Roberts message was countered by People for the American Way, which, citing his support for Christian issues, called for a no vote on his nomination. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Do you want more of God's grace? Village Lutheran Church in Ladue is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares, with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Village Lutheran Church is located at 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue. www.villagelutheranchurch.org. Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, 314-993-1834.
Issues Etc. regular guests David Adams, Ken Sherb, Al Schmidt, Ron Feuerhahn, Cameron McKenzie, and Mark Sell have all contributed to our Book of the Month for August, titled The Anonymous God, The Church Confronts Civil Religion and American Society. More information about The Anonymous God is available on our website, issuesetc.org, or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040 for The Anonymous God.
Sunday night on Issues Etc., we're going to be talking with Paul Coughlin, author of the book No More Christian Nice Guy, about Christian Nice Guy Syndrome. He's got a great quote in there at the beginning of his book where he says that many Christians have turned Jesus into the bearded woman. That pretty much says it all. If you want to hear more, listen live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Paul Coughlin will be our guest. We'll talk about Christian Nice Guy Syndrome. Then Monday, Pastor George Borghardt, rapidly becoming, you know, you just run across a guest that gives you a jewels. That just comes with bags of jewels and dumps them out on the desk when you talk with him. Well, George Borghardt is one of those. We're going to talk with him about Paris Hilton theology. I'll be honest with you, folks, I have no idea what that's about, but we'll find out Monday. I'll know before we actually talk with him, but you'll find out Monday on Issues Etc. Intelligent design is the subject. Dr. David Menton is our guest. He's professor emeritus of anatomy at Washington University here in St. Louis, and he's a speaker for Answers in Genesis. By the way, their website address is answersingenesis.org. Very easy to remember, answersingenesis.org. Now we'll take your questions and comments on creation, evolution, and intelligent design for the next half hour of the program. We're coming to you live this Friday. It's August the 26th, a rare Friday edition of Issues Etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Menton, what is this concept of irreducible complexity? And what role does it play in this whole debate between creationists and evolutionists, or intelligent designers and evolutionists?
Well, one of the chief players in the so-called intelligent design movement is a professor, I think he's at Lehigh University, or Leahy, is it? And he has come up with the idea of irreducible complexity, and it was written in his book Darwin's Black Box, which may be familiar to some of the readers here. Behe certainly doesn't take a specifically Christian view of creation. He doesn't talk about a creator in the sense of God being the creator, as indeed most intelligent design people do not. They try to kind of keep it on a purely academic level. And he argues that one of the major lines of evidence is there are certain very complicated structures in the body which, if you were to remove one part, they no longer would work. And he calls this irreducible complexity. You could always argue, for example, that you don't need the whole eye the way it appears in a vertebrate. You know, you could live without certain features. I mean, so what if the lens didn't focus? I mean, I'm getting to an age in my life where I can tell you my lens doesn't focus at all anymore, and I'm able to get along with the help of glasses. But even if I didn't have glasses, I mean, I would still survive. And so his point is, look, the evolutionist can always come up with, you know, a simpler eye and say, well, we didn't need the whole complicated eye with focusing lens. It could have begun with maybe some little light-sensitive spot, and this finally developed a lens to kind of focus the light on this spot, make it more efficient, and on you go till you get to the vertebrate eye. And so what he's done is to come up with some examples that he feels are irreducible. And one of these that he mentions quite often is what's called the flagellar motor. And the flagellar motor is really certain bacteria have a flagellum, or kind of a tail, if you will. And this tail spins at an incredible rate. I mean, at a speed that vastly exceeds any electric motor that we normally think of, and is able to stop in one quarter turn and go the other direction, I might say, and that this flagellar motor has a rotor, it has a stator, it has all of the components you'd expect to see in an electric motor. And his whole point is that here's this bacterium that has this incredibly complex motor that spins its little tail. And the components of this motor are actually molecules, the proteins. And he says if you remove any component here, the motor doesn't run, the tail doesn't spin, the bacterium doesn't move. And he feels that this is the most, you know, compelling evidence that we have this irreducible complexity. I agree that that's very nice thing to think about. Some evolutionists have pointed out that certain proteins do appear in other organisms and what have you that are in the flagellar motor. But I don't think something has to be irreducible to show that it is the product of intelligent design. I think that the eye, with all of its complexity, is certainly every bit as powerful evidence of intelligent design as the bacterium's little spinning tail.
But Behe's point is simply, how could a thing evolve into the thing it is if minus any part? And that would be kind of,
that's right. That's his whole point.
Kind of engineering back from the end product. You take away any part and it doesn't function, then how do you get from proteins that may be found elsewhere to the proteins arranged in such a way to spin the flagellum on the bacterium?
That's right. And, of course, the evolutionists always have answers. If you allow me to play the evolutionist now, you can come in and point out, well, some of the proteins that appear in the flagellar motor are used for other purposes, so that they could have pre-adapted or pre-evolved to function for other purposes and then just kind of fortuitously were pressed into service for the flagellar motor.
They're really arguing essentially for accidents, right?
Well, absolutely. You know, once you eliminate the whole possibility, and this is something I think people need to understand. This is not simply the usual kind of argument we have, like what's better, Fords or Chevrolets. In this controversy, the evolutionists look at the whole idea of a creator and intelligent design as not simply being wrong. I mean, if it were wrong, we could discuss it, right? We often discuss things with people where we think the other person's wrong, but we at least respect their opinion, and we just simply try to argue where we think they're wrong and we're right. But evolutionists do not say that those who believe in a creator or even an intelligent design are wrong. They say that their views are unthinkable. And it's this unthinkability that completely removes any idea of purpose or design from the viewpoint of many evolutionists. And this is what we're running into in the classroom. We've actually defined science as being a purely mechanistic process. And that's not unreasonable as long as science deals with the ongoing. In other words, hearts beat. They're beating even as we speak. And they can be studied. If you wonder what makes them beat, why do they beat at a certain frequency, what's timing them, how do the muscles contract, all of this can be studied, and if somebody disagrees with your explanation, they themselves can look at the heart and see whether, you know, your own views are correct or not. But when we ask not how does the heart beat, but we ask the question, how did we come to have hearts before there were any hearts? That's a very different question. And what the scientific community is largely assuming is that there is a purely materialistic answer to that question, how we come to have hearts, just as there is a materialistic answer for how the heart beats. And I think those are two very different things. We can see the difference when we look at an automobile. You know, we could study a Ford Taurus and see how all of its parts work. And we could learn this from looking no further than the car itself. But if we ask the question, how did we come to have a Ford Taurus in the first place? Where did the whole idea of the design of this car come from? Then we would have to look away from the parts of the car and ask questions like, well, who designed and built this thing anyway?
Isn't that really the key idea? You said you talked earlier about information. And isn't that really the basic observation of intelligent design, that there is information?
Absolutely. That's where the rubber hits the road, and this is where evolution has absolutely and totally failed. How can you take from a background of chaos, starting with, say, the Big Bang, even dispersion of matter expanding in space, how can we start from that and produce Albert Einstein's brain? There simply is no way that has ever been demonstrated. I mean, what does the average person observe, which is absolutely compelling? You observe that animals reproduce after their kind, right? Dogs give rise to puppies. Cats give rise to kittens. And this is what the Bible tells us. When God created the various kinds, animals reproduced after their kind. Now, a kind might include a rather broad range of animals. Today, we know, as I've already mentioned, that all of the varieties of dogs, of which we recognize about 200, as well as the dingoes and the jackals and the coyotes and the wolves and what have you, they all potentially interbreed and are one kind. Now, they have divided off, even in nature, into different groups, wolves and jackals and coyotes and domestic dogs. But I believe God would have created those as one kind, and the variability that we see is due to the diversity in the genome. The issue is not how do we get variety. That we can see, and we understand that. It involves a principle called multiple alleles, different versions of genes that are available. No two individuals are absolutely alike. Turns out not even identical twins are alike. But the problem for the evolutionist is not to merely describe the well-known phenomena of variation within kind, but to explain how we can develop fundamentally new organisms with unprecedented features and organs, animals of an entirely new higher taxonomic group. This has never been observed. And I wish that in our classrooms, in our schools today, that if we feel we really must get involved with the issue of origins, that we would critically evaluate the evidence, critically evaluate the fossil record, critically evaluate whether random mutations and natural selection can produce higher levels of genetic information. Frankly, I would prefer they didn't get involved with origins. You know, all the years that I taught on the faculty of the medical school, I can tell you that if you could wave a wand and make evolution disappear, it would have no negative impact on the training of physicians or the practice of medicine. I mean, for all of the concern that we hear among teachers and everything today, you know, worrying about, well, if we can't teach evolution, it'll be the end of the world or people can't be scientists, I can tell you based on years of experience at some of America's most prestigious medical institutions, Mayo Clinic, Washington University, that there is nothing essential in evolution for the practice of medicine or training people in medicine or the kind of research that goes on. You can study how bacteria become resistant to drugs without ever invoking anything in the way of an evolutionary view. There are very, very good empirical reasons why bacteria become resistant to drugs. And by the way, it involves the loss of genetic information, not gaining new genetic information.
Hmm. We're talking with Dr. David Menton. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're coming to you with a special live Friday edition of Issues Etc. today, August the 26th. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dave is calling from St. Charles. Dave, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, I'd like to just interject a comment that's pertinent here in terms of the panicked stance of the, quote, scientific community against anything that's even intelligent design or challenging evolution, such that their whole worldview bases on this. If there's any crack in the dam, such thing as abortion and all kind of other studies and cloning and everything else falls. And so they're absolutely panicked and cannot even abide by this. So I think it's pertinent here.
Dave, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Menton, your response?
Oh, I couldn't agree with him more. I mean, I just simply say, bingo, he's got it. No, the whole worldview collapses. We're not talking science arguing against science. If we were, we could certainly go into the classroom and deal with this. This is all a religious issue. There is a religious worldview behind the totally materialistic evolutionary paradigm. And by the way, evolution's not a theory. Let me interject this right now. I have people tell me all the time, I don't have to believe in evolution because it's only a theory. I tell them that if evolution were a theory, they ought to consider believing in it. Because a theory is a very honorable subject and idea. It means a explanation that has already been subjected to tests that could have disproven it and have not thus far been able to disprove it. And theories really work best with empirical science. But in evolution, how does one design an experiment to disprove the hypothesis that life evolved from a methane ammonia atmosphere? How does one design an experiment to disprove the hypothesis that man evolved from distinctly non-human primates? These are worldviews that are merely accepted and believed, and this is why you get the hostility, because when you scratch an evolutionist, you scratch his religion. And the hostility just leaps out. I mean, we can't even discuss this in the classroom. And I'll tell you, I've simply despaired of the public schools ever being able to deal with this in a useful way. I just don't think it's going to happen. I'm sorry, but that's just the way I read it.
So what would it look like, even though I understand your negative prognosis for the public schools in considering something like intelligent design or even a basic challenge to the evolutionary model, but what would it look like if we could critically evaluate all comers, all hypotheses and theories, and could in a biology classroom, for instance, say, all right, here's one explanation, now here regardless of its merit. Here's another explanation, now here regardless of its merit. Let's examine the merits of both.
Well, I certainly think, you know, this could be done. And even if we weren't to introduce any new ideas like, say, creation or whatever, we could go about it this way. We could say, rightly or wrongly, for better or worse, evolution is the only game in town. I mean, that's it. I mean, evolution is the only explanation that is given for the origin of life, for the origin of all of the fundamentally different kinds of plants and animals. So, okay, if it's going to continue to be that way, then let's leave creation out of it. That means, by the way, let's not criticize creation either, okay? I mean, because it's not even in the game. So we leave it out, and what I would perceive would then happen in the classroom is we'd say evolution is the only game in town, therefore we critically evaluate only evolution. We do not necessarily put anything in its place. We just simply say evolution is an attempt by man to come up with a materialistic explanation for how all of the fundamentally different kinds of animals and plants, indeed life itself, could have occurred by the just intrinsic properties of matter and energy, time, and space. And now we would just systematically go through the evidence for evolution to discuss whether, in fact, it's well-established, well-founded, or not. If this were done, and I think the evolutionists are aware of this, this is why they resist so vigorously, if this were done, evolution would go into a real tailspin. Students would find the subject interesting for the first time. You know, one thing that encourages me is the way evolution is taught in such a dogmatic way, it's incredibly boring. I mean, it's just simply boring. The teachers tell the students what they're supposed to believe, and then on the exams they parrot back what they've just been told. But if you could go into the classroom, and I know that this can be done because I've done it in public high schools, go into the classroom and start kicking the gong around. Like, currently it's argued that Neanderthal man isn't even Homo sapiens. For years, we considered Neanderthal man to be Homo sapiens, in other words, true man. But now we consider him to be Homo neanderthalensis. In fact, we argue that he's not even related to man. Now, what is the evidence for this change in status for an individual for which we have a great deal of evidence, not only anatomical from several hundred specimens, but we have a lot of social and cultural evidence. We've even found flutes that are playable that were made by Neanderthal man. We see evidence of medical care. We see evidence of special, almost religious burials with certain positions of the body and with certain trinkets and articles and what have you. What's the evidence that Neanderthal man is unrelated, as they now say, to modern man, didn't even interbreed with him? This could be interesting for the students. You know, we could talk about the mitochondrial DNA. I mean, we could get into some real science in the classroom instead of this just indoctrination that we now have. And as long as the, I mean, I'll just put this out to the evolutionary community out there. As long as you do not permit anyone to question you, as long as you just dogmatically teach that evolution and have the students parrot it back, it is simply going to be boring. And you're not going to get anywhere. I mean, they're very puzzled. Why are there still people who doubt evolution after all these years of indoctrination? The reason they doubt it is it's intuitively seemed to be absurd.
Now, we're going to respond to a few callers here in the very last few minutes, so we'll respond quickly. First to Phil calling from his car. Phil, welcome.
Hi. I was wondering how do you deal with people that believe in God, but they think that God used evolution to bring us along?
About a one-minute response here, Dr. Menten.
Okay, as for what God did or did not do, how would we know unless he wrote us a book or told us what he did, right? And I believe he did write us a book. The book that he wrote is called the Bible. And if we wonder what God did, you know, we just simply look at the Bible. So I'm really not interested in what somebody thinks God might have done or could have done. I'm only interested in what did God say he did. And in the scriptures, it says he created everything by the power of his word from out of nothing. He did so in 6 days, described as having sunrises and sunsets.
Let's talk with Joel. Joel calls from his car. Hi, Joel.
Hi, how you doing? I was just wondering, I kind of like the comment about the dog and the variations that we got from the dog and how that can happen. And so I've always gone back to this idea, trying to put it in a simplest layman's term here instead of getting too a little bit too difficult. I've always said to myself, okay, well, then why isn't there, and I think you just touched on this, why isn't there variations of man going all the way from apes to man, like we have Neanderthal man walking around the face of the earth in certain parts, or you know, Bigfoot or whatever the heck this is, and then we have even before apes. Why don't we have, like, millions of variations? And I believe it's because I like the theory, I like the fact that God created groups.
Joel, we got to let you go here because our time is very short. Dr. Menten, less than a minute here to respond to Joel's comments.
Okay, the variability that we see among dogs still leaves us with dogs, be they so different, like Chihuahuas and Rottweilers and what have you, but they still are dogs, you know, and the variations that we see among humans are still humans, whether they're Australian Aboriginal or Caucasian or whatever they may be, they're still human. In fact, we now see that there's really only one race of humans. We don't even divide human beings into races. And yet, when we look at Neanderthal man, we put him in a different species. You know, we could do that with humans today. We could take black folks and put them in a different species than white folks, but we don't do that because that would be profoundly racist. But we do it with Neanderthal man because they're not in a position to fight back. Believe me, as a human anatomist, I can tell you, Neanderthal man is 100% human. Homo sapiens, period.
Dr. David Menton is Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University here in St. Louis and a very able-bodied speaker for Answers in Genesis. Dr. Menton, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for being our guest.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
The website address for Answers in Genesis, answersingenesis.org, answersingenesis.org. Coming up here in November, in a related way, you know, evolution is not only wrong when it looks back, it's wrong when it looks forward. It has implications. It is, as Dr. Menton said, a worldview, and worldviews matter because worldviews lead to all sorts of circumstances. Dr. Menton will be one of the speakers at the Image of God Bioethics Conference coming up November the 11th. That's a Friday here in St. Louis. And you will also be hearing about many of the worldviews that come out of an evolutionary model and a critique of them in terms of their bioethics. You don't have to be a doctor, you don't have to be a scientist, you don't have to be an ethicist to attend this conference Friday, November the 11th here in St. Louis. Anyone is welcome. Everyone is welcome. We hope to be broadcasting live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference Friday, November the 11th here in St. Louis. For more information, you go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look on the homepage. You'll see there a logo, the Image of God Bioethics Conference. Click on it, and you'll find out more about this conference that's coming up. If you are concerned about the life issue, if you're concerned about abortion, cloning, euthanasia, about where evolution leads us in bioethics, this is the conference for you. Dr. David Menton will be speaking there among many other Issues Etc. regular guests. Now, when we come back from this break, Dr. Jeff Gibbs is a regular guest on this program, preached a recent sermon in the chapel of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We'll do a sermon review of his short homily on Psalm 25, verses 1 through 7. I'll tell you in advance, folks, this is a textual sermon, and you'll find out what I mean by that when we come back. We'll go through our diagnostic and evaluate the sermon by Dr. Jeff Gibbs. Then, in the last 25 minutes or 15 minutes or so, Scott Klusendorf joins us to talk about the latest story from JAMA on fetal pain. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.